It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is requesting the state Supreme Court consider the state's police use of force law when someone is attempting to escape arrest. Colin Deppen reported on the upcoming case for Spotlight PA and joins us now. Hello, Colin.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Colin, Krasner was a guest on The Confluence in the spring. He's bringing up this use of force statute because he's set to try ex-officer Ryan Palnall, who shot and killed 30-year-old David Jones as he ran from a traffic stop. Jones was unarmed. The question in front of the high court has to do with jury instructions for similar cases in common pleas court. What are the current procedures for judges in instructing juries?
As it's currently laid out, Pennsylvania law establishes certain parameters for the use of deadly force. Krasner's appeal focuses on a nearly 40-year-old Supreme Court ruling that establishes a slightly narrower set of parameters for the use of deadly force. So under this appeal, he wants that court to weigh in on whether the jury instructions, the outlining of the rules that they weigh guilt or innocence by, mm-hmm. in cases like ex-officer Ryan Pownall's, are constitutional and comport with that nearly 40-year-old Supreme Court ruling that, again, set that slightly higher bar.
Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court you're referring to is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling?
That's correct.
And that was in a case involving, it was Tennessee versus Gardner, I believe. Tell us a little bit about that and what the U.S. Supreme Court found at that time.
So Tennessee versus Gardner was a high court decision that came a couple of years after an unarmed 15-year-old who'd committed a fairly minor act of theft was shot by police in the back as he attempted to flee by scaling a fence. And so when the high court looked at this case, it decided that deadly force to prevent an escape alone is unconstitutional. There must be an added component, which would be the belief, probable cause, the officer having probable cause to believe that fleeing suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or other people. And again, Krasner's appeal says that the way jurors in Pennsylvania hear our state statute does not line up with that. Is a slightly weaker standard, and should be elevated.
Mm-hmm. And so the U.S. Supreme Court ruling didn't really impact Pennsylvania's use of force laws. What you're saying?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there are a dozen, maybe two dozen states with similar so-called fleeing felon rules on the books. Pennsylvania is by no means alone in this. Some 40 years after that Supreme Court decision, again, coming from the highest court in the land. So, yes, not a Pennsylvania-specific issue. Certainly other states have this laid out as well.
Mm-hmm. To clarify, what Krasner wants, he seems to want to swap in the word "and" for the word "or" in Pennsylvania statute as part of the conditions where officers can use deadly force justifiably. So that would raise the bar for officers when using deadly force.
Certainly. And the semantics are important here. The ands and ors in Pennsylvania's law, per Krasner's reading here, allows officers or jurors, in this case, to check certain boxes in deciding whether deadly force was justifiable. Krasner's appeal essentially says that all of those boxes need to be checked in order to comport with that U.S. Supreme Court, that Tennessee versus Gardner decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1980s.
So what does the defense, Pownall's lawyer, say to this effort?
In essence, that he acted within state law and is being tried in accordance with state law. They sort of see no issue here, and certainly he is not without his supporters. But it's worth noting that Krasner's argument also includes a mention that this act itself was a violation of Philadelphia policy, Philadelphia Police Department policy, which mirrors that Tennessee versus Garner decision that Krasner wants to see those jury instructions more aligned with.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. A reminder, this is the argument that Michael Rosfeld used successfully in being acquitted in the shooting death of Antoine Rose, the unarmed black teenager who was fleeing a traffic stop, 3 years ago. So do advocates of these changes think a change with how judges speak to a jury is the key?
Maybe not. I mean, in terms of how this would impact or influence trial outcomes, not everyone is convinced that this will make or break a case, so to speak. And the reason for that is, as anyone who has had jury duty before knows, jury instructions themselves can be pretty voluminous and dense. There is certainly a human tendency to sort of gloss over or even miss some of the finer details and the legalese and the subtext here. So not everyone is sure that this will actually have as big an outcome, certainly as supporters of the change hope it would.
Mm-hmm. Just about 30 seconds, Colin. So a judicial branch decision could impact legislative branch. Democratic Representative Summer Lee and Ed Gainey introduced legislation to change the law last session. That never made it out of committee. So is there any movement for a similar proposal currently? Just a couple sentences, please.
At the moment, no, but State Representative Gainey did tell us that he is looking to sort of pick up where they left off, rebuild that momentum, and hopes they can build the necessary consensus to move the bill forward where it was unable to move forward previously.
Okay. Colin Deppen is with Spotlight PA, the investigative news partnership covering state government and politics. Colin, thanks so much for your reporting, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Slightly more than 60% of Allegheny County residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But how many of those vaccinated are pregnant and postpartum individuals? A new study from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is partnering with UPMC McGee Women's Hospital to learn more about this particular population and their newborns. Dr. Katie Bungie is with Pitt School of Medicine's Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. She's the local principal investigator for this study. Dr. Bungie, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So tell us about this study. What are you observing? What do you want to learn?
Well, I'm really excited about the study, actually. We're one of many sites across the country. Right now, there are 9 sites participating. And while we really firmly believe that the COVID vaccines are safe for pregnant and postpartum individuals, and we have data already out there to suggest that the antibodies that our bodies make are transferred to the babies, what we're missing is really a better understanding about how long those antibodies are present when the individual that gets vaccinated is pregnant or postpartum during that vaccination series. That's really the focus of our study, is to figure out how long those antibodies are present. We also want to describe the transfer of the antibodies to the baby. So we're doing what's called an observational study. By observational, what I mean is that we aren't giving the vaccine to participants. Rather, the participants are receiving the vaccine through a vaccine clinic or a pharmacy somewhere else. But we step in and we follow the participants and their infants for a year after delivery, watching what happens. But we'll also be collecting pregnancy outcome data, meaning were the rates of preterm delivery, for example, and we'll also be looking at infant safety data too, so that we might add to the growing body of literature that supports the safety of these vaccines in pregnant and postpartum patients.
Mm-hmm. So, Doctor, how long will this study be going on?
We're going to be enrolling for the next 6 months, and then we follow the participants for a year, so for a good couple years now.
In January, we spoke with Dr. Richard Beege, president of UPMC McGee, who is the national investigator of this study. He told us that with the exclusion of pregnant people from vaccine trials, you don't have the data you need. And because of that, quote, some women indeed are less likely or less inclined to take the vaccine. So then that also perpetuates less use and also less data to be gathered in that manner. And it's a kind of catch-22, end quote. So months after the vaccine first became available, has either hesitancy changed among your clients, your patients?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when the, and you've hit on a really important point, which is a detriment to pregnant and postpartum individuals that they are not included in these efficacy trials of new drugs and vaccines. So that is an important growing movement within the field of obstetrics and gynecology to get these populations into clinical trials early on so that we have that really important safety data to share with our patients. But to answer your specific question, for sure, hesitancy has decreased since we've had more and more experience with the vaccinations. So I would say when the vaccines were first rolled out, I was limited in what I could tell my patients about what we knew about the safety of these vaccines in pregnant and postpartum patients. You know, I could tell them that we had no reason to think that there would be a problem. They're safe in a non-pregnant population. The virus isn't live, so it wouldn't affect the fetus. The mechanism of action of these viruses is certainly, in theory, safe for pregnant women. So it was a lot of theoretical talk, whereas now we have much more data as more pregnant and postpartum people have gotten vaccinated to reassure our patients that they are safe.
What do you hope to learn from someone who recently gave birth versus someone who is still pregnant?
So our bodies, when we become pregnant and then right after we deliver, are really different in terms of the amount of blood, and our immune systems are different. So they're quite different populations, pregnant and postpartum patients, different from each other and also different from non-pregnant or postpartum patients. So the primary reason why we're doing this study is to understand how our immune system creates antibodies and how robust that response is and how long those antibodies stick around. And so it's really quite important to think about these populations differently, pregnant, postpartum, and then non-pregnant or postpartum.
Doctor, what is the risk of the COVID-19 disease like for pregnant individuals?
Pregnant people who get COVID-19 while they're pregnant are at an increased risk of more severe effects from the virus than non-pregnant people. So they have higher rates of hospital admissions, ICU admissions, things like this. We also have some data to suggest that should a pregnant person contract COVID while they are pregnant, they have a slightly increased risk of preterm birth compared to a pregnant person who doesn't get COVID while they're pregnant.
Any other data at this point on the potential impact on the unborn baby once it is born?
There have been a couple of case reports of actually transmission of COVID to the fetus, but that's thought to be very, very rare and not something that we usually counsel on. Really, honestly, the biggest impact is maternal disease affecting the baby. So if the mom is not well, by extension, the baby is not well. So if a mom's requiring oxygen, the baby's understandably also in a dangerous situation. So I think that is the biggest risk. And then the data surrounding preterm birth is concerning as well, because a baby who's born early is at risk for infections and complications compared to a baby that's born at term.
Do you think the results of this study will help researchers decide whether to include pregnant people in vaccine trials in the future?
Yes, I really do. I think it comes back to this concern and issue that pregnant and postpartum individuals are often excluded from clinical trials. And this comes from a place where they were thought to be vulnerable populations, but by excluding them from these really important clinical trials, we actually make them vulnerable because we don't have good safety data to provide when the product is available to them. So I think the more we can look at pregnant and postpartum people earlier in the development of medicines and vaccines, the better. And I truly believe that this study will be impactful in that way.
Dr. Katie Bungie is with Pitt's Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Services. She's the local principal investigator for a national study of pregnant and postpartum people and the COVID vaccine. Doctor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Laura Satsui. Higher education is often couched as a path out of poverty or a way to make a better life for oneself. But what if higher education was understood to reinforce systems of oppression? Dr. Lee Patel is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Education, and she studies decolonization and education. And her latest book is called No Study Without Struggle, Confronting Settler Colonialism in Higher Education. Dr. Patel, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be joining you.
So to start, let's define something. What do you mean by settler colonialism?
Yes, this is a great question, a really important point. When I was in school, I learned about colonialism where some matriarch, a queen or a king, would extract goods such as spices, tea, coffee from other lands and peoples. Settler colonialism is different in that it is still in large part about extraction, but also about occupation. So arriving to a land as outsiders and then claiming that land as your own.
Where do we see settler colonialism in higher education?
So we can see it from the obvious fact that colleges and universities, be they private or public, are on indigenous lands. But it's also the relationship between universities and communities. So in Pittsburgh and in Western Pennsylvania, a great deal of research is conducted usually on, more than with, minoritized populations. That research sometimes benefits those populations that are being studied, but more quickly it benefits the researcher doing the study. So settler colonialism is about this, firstly, it's erasure of indigeneity.
Are there ways that universities and educators can appropriately acknowledge this system and even perhaps like make up for the harm done to others?
I think so. I know so, actually. There are lots of ways that we can interrupt what's been a long-running train. And so ways for universities to reckon with, and that word reckon is one that I think is a really powerful one, because it says that the only way to actually deal with these inequities is with the truth. That's how we deal with them. That's how we unlearn the mythologies that we were taught in K-12 schooling and sometimes in higher education. We unlearn those which makes space to learn how to be in better relation with each other. So, for example, I would love for my students and my peers, other faculty and administrators, to know that where the School of Education, where we're physically located, is in a building whose address is Bouquet Street. And that street is named for Colonel Henry Bouquet, who oversaw the distribution of blankets infected with smallpox to indigenous peoples of that area and being forcibly moved through that area in the 1760s. Which is without a doubt an act of chemical warfare. I would love for us to know this so that we grapple with what does it mean to be connected to this history? How can we teach it so as not to reproduce an absence of knowledge of it? That moves us closer to being in right relation with history.
We see in Texas legislators trying to restrict what can be taught about the history of racism in this country. As an educator seeking to decolonize education, like, is this taking three steps back?
Yeah, if not, they think that's actually a pretty shy number of steps back. But what's really important about it is not how many steps. It's what it is actually, it's a reaction. It's a reaction to that having had our first African-American president. It's a reaction to the ways that Georgia was flipped and voted as a democratically strong state, was part of President Biden being elected. So it's not really about critical race theory. And so the legislation, of which there are dozens, I'm not terribly shocked by it, but I am, of course, very deeply concerned about it, because bottom line, when we cordon off facts about how the nation came into existence, what we're giving up is accuracy. And that will weaken any society that claims to be one that is democratic.
Finally, you mentioned near the end of the book that it could be seen as, you don't use this word, but I will use the word maybe ironic, that you point all of this out, but you're also a faculty of a university. So I don't know. What do you say to that potential irony?
Yes, a wonderful question. So I'll say two things. One is that there's not a day when, as a faculty member and as a former administrator, I don't tussle with or wrestle with, you know, some of the constraints, but I also do my best to try to find imaginative ways of doing things. And I work with fantastic colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh, where, for example, well, let's do admissions differently. Instead of really valuing who has written a letter of recommendation, which is shorthand for social capital, let's study what are the knowledge systems that this person is bringing as they're applying to our school. That's kind of a small but pretty deep change. So I think at every opportunity, there's inequity and opportunity for equity to happen even more fully. And the second thing, it's this: learning is bigger than all of this. So as much as settler colonialism reproduces who is a professor or who is like the image of authority, learning itself is bigger than all of that. So even within the university, and it's any university, and we've seen this with Nicole Hannah Jones being denied tenure, Cornel West being asked to leave Harvard University or choosing to leave after being denied tenure. In all of these places, when we can see these patterns of people of color, particularly queer people, disabled people, trans people, being told like, please no. All of these places still have learning going on. So I refuse to give it up.
Leigh Patel is a professor in the School of Education at the University of Pittsburgh. Her book, No Study Without Struggle, is available now to read. Leigh, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Leigh Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.